I like to start any presentation that I do by talking about family rules. I think it's one of the finest ways that we can have a good family is to be aware of our rules. Family rules are usually unspoken, unconscious, but understood. I think a better way is for how family rules to be spoken, conscious, and understood. That way we can renegotiate if we need to. I like to have three rules when I'm doing a gospel meeting, workshop, or anything else. Number one, try not to learn very much. That'll be easy with me leading this discussion. Now, do we have anybody here still in school? I don't see any school. If there's anybody who's we got one. Don't take that advice for school. It'll mess you up and you'll fail. But since I've gotten out of school and don't have to take tests anymore, that's my philosophy of learning. If I'm reading a book, listening to a CD, attending a seminar, I try not to learn very much, but I try to learn something. I try to get a mustard seed that will make a difference. Jesus said, if you have faith as a grain of mustard seed, you can move a mountain. And that's about all we need to do this afternoon, about one good sized mountain. So try not to learn much, but learn something that will be helpful. Number two, I don't know how tired you are. Yesterday was a short day for me. I went to bed at 1:15 in the morning, got up at 5:30 and flew down here. So I was kind of tired yesterday. You may be in that shape today. Don't know what kind of medicine you're taking. And so if you nod a little bit, or if you just flat out go to sleep, it's not going to offend me. You don't have to apologize. Won't bother me at all. Now, when I was a younger preacher, that bothered me. Sometimes hurt my feelings, make me angry. I thought it was an insult on my preaching, but we can learn a lot if we'll really read the Bible. You read Acts chapter 20, and there was a man preaching, and a young man by the name of Eutychus went to sleep, fell out of the window, and died. Who was preaching that day? Paul, good preacher, bad preacher, probably a pretty good preacher. So the fact that people sleep when you're preaching doesn't necessarily mean the preaching's bad. Secondly, we can learn a lot from experience. I started preaching 50 years ago when I was 16 years old. It was in November 1962 down at the Wolf Creek Church of Christ in Hickman County, Tennessee. I was about halfway through my sermon. I said in Hebrews 10 verses 25 and 26... Pow, hit the floor, went to sleep right in the middle of my own sermon. Literally, they took me on to Dr. Parker Elrod at Centerville. Later, I went into Nashville the next day, had a complete physical by Dr. Morris Katiski, and both of them said, you were just exhausted. I was playing guard on a high school basketball team. Friday night, we had a double court press going both ways, played hard all night long. Daddy was building a rock house, hauled rocks all day on Saturday, went bowling Saturday night, got up early on Sunday morning. And about halfway through the sermon, it's time for a nap, and I took one. So I thought about that. If I sleep when I preach, why should I be insulted if other people sleep? So you have permission to sleep. Number three, I like to have a wastebasket. We have an imaginary wastebasket here. And if I say something that's not worth taking home, feel free to put it in the wastebasket. And I like to put a filter on the wastebasket. If I say something from the Bible, and we're going to mention the Bible quite a bit, don't throw anything away that God says. But there will be many things because of the practical nature of what we're talking about. I'll say it's my opinion. This is my observation. Here's what I think. I think it's pretty good or I wouldn't say it, but you may not think it's worth taking home and you can throw it away. Can we live with those rules? Is that agreeable? Okay, let's talk. Let's talk. 7 weeks to renewed faith in your home. Number one, we need to understand what faith is. Faith is number one. It is belief. Hebrews 10:17. So then faith comes by hearing and hearing by the word of God. And so belief is believing truth. Truth is a system of non-contradictory information. That's a bone that I have with at least one or two modern translations. It translates some principles in there as truths, plural. There's no such thing as truths. It is truth. It is singular. And so therefore, I need to believe, I need to read, and I need to believe and say, yep, that's the way it is. But that's not all that faith is. Secondly, faith is trust. That means in view of what I believe about God and about what He says, that I lean on that and that I risk and that I invest in that, knowing that it's going to be wise. 2 Timothy 1:12, Paul was in prison, a dirty, stinking Roman prison. He said, I'm a preacher, I'm an apostle, I'm a teacher of the Gentiles. For this reason I also suffer these things. Nevertheless, I am not ashamed, for I know whom I have believed and am persuaded that He is able to keep that which I have committed to Him until that day. Paul, aren't you discouraged? Not at all. Aren't you ashamed? Not at all. Why? God's going to make everything right. It reminds me of an atheist I heard years ago living in a small community, and he liked to flaunt his atheism. And he wrote a letter to the editor of the local paper, and he said, "I just want you to know that I plowed my ground on Sunday and didn't go to church. And I sowed my crops on Sunday, and I fertilized and cultivated on Sunday, and I gathered on my crops on Sunday, and I made as many or more barrels to the acre than any Christian in this county. How do you explain that?" And the editor said, "God doesn't settle all his accounts in October." And that's what Paul was saying. God's going to make everything right. And so we need to learn to trust. Luke 6:38, Jesus says, "Give, it will be given to you, full measure, pressed down, shaking together, and running over will men give into your bosom, for the same measure you meet, with all it shall be measured to you again." When our children were growing up, we had some rules in our home. One of the rules that we gave, I let them decide how much they wanted to give. They had to give a percentage. And so one of my children gave 11%, and it had to be above 10%. Anything above 10%. So one of them gave 11% and 1/13. Weren't they liberal? One week, though, we had one of our young ladies in an automobile accident, and nobody had any insurance. She didn't have any insurance, and the car in which she was riding had any insurance. And so our elder said, "We're having a special contribution this day. We want you to give everything above what you usually give. We're going to give to this family." And so at our family devotional, one of our family devotionals during the week, we talked about it. So I said, "Jerry Wayne, what are you going to give? Christy, what are you going to give?" "Well, Daddy, I always give 11%. I give 13%. "Okay, I know that, but this week the elders asked us to give some extra. So I want you to think about how much extra you're going to give, and I want you to tell me next Sunday night how much you gave extra, and I want to promise you, I want to see how much you trust your daddy. I want to promise you that whatever extra you give, you will never, after next Sunday night, you'll never regret it. I promise you that. I want to see how much you trust that." Well, that Sunday night, we got together, and I said, "Okay, it's time for us to talk about how much extra we gave." And I think one of them gave $1 extra, gave their 11%, then $1. And so I got out my checkbook, and I wrote them a check. We'd already written them both a letter. "Dear Jerry Wayne, dear Christy, we're proud of you. We're proud of the way you love the Lord and trust Him. And whatever you have decided to give today, we're going to give you 10 times as much." And so the one that gave $1, I wrote a check, $10. The other gave $2 and gave them $20. They said, "Well, thank you. This is wonderful." And then it hit my daughter. She said, Daddy, I've got $600 in the bank. What if I had given all of that $600? I said, "Christy, your mother and I discussed that. And we had decided that if we needed to, we'd take out a loan and we would have given you 10 times what you gave." "Oh, Daddy," she said, "will you give me one more chance?" Well, that was the last time we ever did that, but I hope maybe that made an impression. Mark chapter 9, I think one of the ways that we can grow our faith in our home, we can have a renewed faith in our home, is we're learning to trust that we give permission to doubt. I believe that faith grows through creative doubt. Mark chapter 9 is one of my favorite faith passages. A man came to Jesus whose son had an affliction, and often it would throw him into the fire and often into the water. And he said, "Lord, I've been to your disciples and they couldn't do anything about it." He said, "If you can do anything, have compassion on us and help us." And Jesus said, if you believe, all things are possible to him who believes. I like the way Jesus put the "if" back on him. See, he "if" Jesus. If you can do anything, have compassion. Jesus said, "No, the "if" is not on me. The "if" is on you. If you can believe." Now, listen to the man. "Immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, 'Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief.'" Wow, that's scary. What's Jesus going to do to a man who admits that he doesn't have complete faith? He has some doubts. He has some faith and he has some doubts. What's the Lord going to do? Is he going to go home, get your faith fixed, and then we'll see if we can help you? No, he healed that boy. See, I think the Lord appreciated his honesty, his faith, and his doubts. I believe that faith. And so I want an atmosphere. I always wanted an atmosphere in my home where we could express our doubts as well as our faith. And it's okay to talk about that. A man who influenced me tremendously as a preacher used to look. He was a counselor, a psychologist, and I'd never talked to one until I met him, and I was scared to death of it. The first Monday he was in our building, he would work there a day or week. He asked me if I wanted to go out and eat lunch with him, and I lied to him and told him I did. I didn't want to talk to him. And while we were eating lunch, I talked continuously. I do that all the time, but I really worked hard at it that day because I didn't want to give him any time to ask any questions. I didn't want him figuring me out. And so, but as we finally gained trust in each other, he would get a dreamy look in his eye and he'd say, "Jerry, I dream of a place and a time where Christians can get together and tell the truth." And I said, "He is weird." I thought Christians were supposed to tell the truth all the time, but the longer we talked, the more I knew what he was talking about. It's good to have a place where you can really tell the truth, and the home needs to be a place like that. It was comforting to me when I started reading passages such as Psalm 77. See, I got an idea that you couldn't question God, and you shouldn't ever ask any questions. You're supposed to just have complete faith all the time. And then I started reading these passages. Psalm 77, "I cried out to God with my voice, to God with my voice, and he gave ear to me in the day of my trouble. I sought the Lord. My hand was stretched out in the night without ceasing. My soul refused to be comforted. I remembered God and was troubled." Wait a minute. I thought you're supposed to remember God and everything's going to be okay. He said, "No, I remembered God and was troubled. I complained and my spirit was overwhelmed." I didn't think you could complain to God. Yeah, you can do that if you read the Bible. And here's what he says to God. "You hold my eyelids open. I'm so troubled that I cannot speak. I've considered the days of old, the years of ancient times. I call to remembrance my song of the night. I meditate within my heart and my spirit makes diligent search. Will the Lord cast off forever? Will he be favorable no more? Has his mercy ceased forever? Has his promise failed forevermore? Has God forgotten to be gracious? Has he in anger shut up his tender mercies? What's going on, God? I don't know if I'll ever smile again." And I said, "This is my anguish, but I will remember the years of the right hand of the Most High. I will remember the works of the Lord. Surely I will remember your wonders of old." See the change there? He is questioning and questioning and questioning. And, you know, is he ever going to do anything right anymore? And he finally, "Whew, I'm glad I got that off my chest." You know, and come think of it, God has done pretty good things at a time or two. And he may even do that again. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that wonderful? Lamentation chapter 3 is one of my favorite chapters in the Old Testament. There Jeremiah says, he said, "The Lord has broken my bones and age my skin. He has shut me in and cut me off. He won't even listen to my prayers. He has filled my loins full of arrows and broken my teeth with gravel. And when I remember this, I have hope." How's that for a motivational speech? That sounds very uncomfortable to me. But then there's that passage we sing, and I sang it in youth meetings and in services for a long time, and I thought it was a happy, clappy song. Everybody's just happy. Let's sing it together. "The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him. The steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They are new every morning. Great is thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, says my soul. Therefore I will hope in him. Therefore I will hope in him." And That's the context. I've asked for that song to be sung at my funeral. But I said, be sure and tell the context. The context was out of deep agony and woe that we can sing, the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. Faith is built up of belief. It's built up of trust. It's built out of response. Acts 16, 30 to 31, the jailer said, sirs, what must I do to be saved? And they said, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ and you'll be saved. And then they preached to him the word of the Lord, and he took them the same hour of the night, washed their stripes, and was baptized, he and all his household. Unless it's otherwise specified in the Bible, when faith, the word faith is used, it always includes belief, trust, and response. It's never just answering the questions, right? It is all three of those, unless it's a little faith or a weak faith or a dead faith. It's always belief, trust, and response. So if we're going to renew faith in our home, we need to understand what faith means. Number two, if I'm going to renew faith in my family, it will really be helpful to me if I can better understand my family. How much faith do I have in God and how much is in my family? I am much of who I am because of Annette Duncan Barber and John Thomas Barber. I grew up in that home and they have influenced me tremendously. I need to be aware of that. I need to understand something of how families operate. Otherwise, I may have characteristics just keep on doing because I think it must be right because that's the way we've always done it. A couple of passages in the Old Testament, God says, I will visit the iniquities of the fathers on the children, third and fourth generation. Exodus 34:7, Numbers 14:18. I have read some material, and if you'd like to read some more, if this is interesting to you, if you'll go to my website, www.barberclippings, Barber Clippings, that stuff that falls off the head of the barber, barberclippings.com. You can go to some books in there under resources, and you'll have some more information on this. But understanding family systems has been helpful. Number one, in family systems, we need to realize that the identified patient is often not the cause of the problems, but where the symptoms surface. Many times families or churches will pick out a black sheep, and that really is enjoyable to the whole family. Because as long as we have a black sheep and blame all our problems on that black sheep, I don't have much responsibility if I'm not the black sheep. You see, the reason we don't have peace and happiness in this family, it's their fault. And so I can't do anything about it. Generally, the identified patient is not the cause of the problems, whether it's in a church or a family or anywhere else, but where the symptoms surface. For instance, if I go to the doctor and my skin is yellow, my doctor's probably not going to tell me to call the Avon lady and get some cosmetics to change my skin tone. Probably going to say we need some liver checks here. Something's not going on right. My dad had heart bypass surgery in 1981. Recovered, did well. 1998, we were in the Smoky Mountains, and he asked my wife, Gail, I've been having some pain in my jaw. Could that be related to my heart? Gail is our resident doctor. If I read medical books, I get the symptom of every disease I read about, so I try to stay away from them. She said, yeah, you need to have that checked out. Daddy called his doctor on Monday and says, I think I need an arteriogram. He went to Nashville on Tuesday, had an arteriogram, second bypass surgery on Wednesday. He was back at work in a couple of weeks. Pain in his jaw, he didn't need to see a dentist. That was not causing the problem. That was simply where the symptoms were surfacing. And so really, in a family, we need to recognize we're all connected. We're all connected. And if a condition is chronic in the family, it's because everybody likes it that way. We like it the way it is better than what it would take to change it. 1 Corinthians 12:26, if one member suffers, all the members suffer with it. Dan, I used to say, if one member suffers, all the members ought to suffer. Don't preach it that way anymore because that's not the way it's written. It's not ought, it's will. I have no choice. If I'm in a family, in a congregation, in a group, I will be affected by what's going on in the group. I don't have any choice as to whether I'm going to hurt. I do have the choice as to whether I'm going to hurt creatively, redemptively, and healingly, or destructively. So number one, the law of the identified patient. Number two, I need to understand the desire of the system to stay balanced. And that is, how can we keep it just like it is? Homeostasis. What does a thermostat do? A thermostat keeps the temperature in an area within a comfort zone. not exactly 72, but it may get down to 68, and then it'll go up to 74, and then it'll cool back down and back and forth. And it'll just keep it in the comfort zone. Our families, our churches, our softball teams, our businesses tend to do the same thing. We stay in a comfort zone. And if we get too far bad, we're going to get it up and try to get it back up to normal. If it gets too good, often it does the same thing. And leaders need to understand that, is that folks are going to sabotage growth, real growth, as much as they resist error and bad stuff. I knew a man one time who worked hard, did well, and one time some conditions came around where it looked like he might lose everything he had. It was just really tough financial conditions. He became depressed and cranky and hard to get along with. And I can understand why. Here's a person who's worked hard all his life and it looks like he may lose everything. But he got through that, and a few years later when he filled out his financial report to turn into his bank, when he got down to the bottom line, net worth, his net worth was over $1 million. How do you think he felt? Most people say, man, felt great. He's a millionaire. The way he felt was depressed, cranky, and hard to get along with. Well, why in the world would he do that? Same reason he felt that way a few years earlier. Both were out of his comfort zone. When he was about to lose everything he had, that was way out of his comfort zone. And when he suddenly saw that magic number, he never dreamed he'd have that much money in his life, and he was out of his comfort zone. And until he adjusted to that new normal, he was resisting. We will try to see, we like it just the way it is. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, Paul writes to the church at Corinth. He said, it's reported that there's fornication among you, and such fornication is not even named among the Gentiles, that a man has his father's wife. He said, I can't believe it. You got not just vanilla fornication, but bad fornication that Gentiles won't even put up with. And what's interesting, instead of reprimanding the man, he said, and you are puffed up and have not rather mourned that he who has done this thing might not be taken away from among you. He said, I'm not just concerned about the man and the woman he's shacking up with. I'm concerned about the whole church because you like it that way. If a condition is chronic, it's that way generally because why are we all here today? Why did we all show up at this place? I've never been here before in my life. Why did we do it? Every one of us did it because we've done everything just exactly right to be where we are today. We followed the map. We all got here. We all got here because we wanted to be here. And that's the way we are in our home and our congregation, softball teams and businesses. We've done everything just exactly right to get where we are today. Third principle. Differentiation. How can we be connected but not stuck? How can we be connected but not stuck? Generally, people do two things in a family if family conditions are bad. Number one, they surrender and just say, whatever you want to do, I'll do it. Or if it's really bad, they say, okay, I'm getting out of here. You're the cause of all my problems and I'm leaving. No, the secret is how can we be connected but not stuck? How can we help people how can I stay with people but not approve of everything that they do? And that's the only way we're going to be able to live with folks, because they're not going to do everything we want them to do. Joshua is the perfect model of that principle. Joshua 24:14-15, he's giving his farewell address to Israel. And he tells them, first of all, he reviews their family history. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. Here's where you came from. He says, therefore, fear the Lord, serve him in sincerity and truth, put away the gods which your father served that were on the other side of the river, serve the Lord. And if it seem evil to you to serve the Lord, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods which your father served that were on the other side of the river, the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. See, some people say the secret is just don't think about it, don't think about it, you can't even talk about it, don't even mention that, that's not an option. No, Joshua didn't say that. He said, you know, here's what I really think you ought to do. I'm an old man, about ready to die, I think you need to fear the Lord, serve the Lord, and put away those gods. But you may not want to do that. And if that's exactly the wrong thing, then you need to decide, well, Joshua, could we? Yeah, he said, think about it. You got all those gods of the Egyptians. probably 10 of those at least. And if that's not enough gods to think about, see, I don't believe people sin because they think about sinning. I believe people sin because they don't think about sinning enough. One of the greatest things we can do in our families is help all of us look at choices and consequences and choices and consequences. But why don't we talk about it? Why don't we talk about it? Let's look. If you did it this way, how might that road end? And so he said, think about it. Oh, so you're taking a poll as to what you're going to be doing. He said, no. I'm not a Gallup poll taker. As for me and my house, we'll serve the Lord, but you're going to have to make up your mind. We can be connected, but not stuck. You don't have to do everything my way. And I'm not going to do everything your way. Let's do it the Lord's way, or you will need to make up your mind what you're going to do about it. Number four, we need to look at the extended family field, and we're going to talk about that handout in just a minute. I'm the result of who I am because of my parents and grandparents and aunts and uncles and cousins. And so I like to ask the question here, were my relatives angels or demons or humans? And how I answer that question is going to make a lot of difference. See, I've known people, and I have two or three in mind that I've heard a lot, that it comes across like they're, I know one fellow, he says, my parents were absolutely perfect. I don't believe they ever did one thing wrong in their world. They are perfect. You must not know your parents very well, because my Bible tells me they weren't that way. And they may not have done you a service by hiding all of that or not giving you permission to talk about it. Your parents, your family probably wasn't angels. Well, mine were just devils. They never did anything. Probably not. They were humans. Probably humans. See, I love to go to Hebrews chapter 11. See, the old model of psychology and working with people is your family is what got you into this mess, and the way you get cured is get away from your family. The family systems model says no. Your family were probably humans, neither angels nor demons. They probably had some good points and some bad points, and God, through giving you free will, gives you the opportunity to imitate the good points and to not follow the bad points. Hebrews chapter 11. I like to ask the question, why were these heroes of faith in Hebrews chapter 11? Was Noah placed as a hero of faith in Hebrews chapter 11 because he built a boat longer than a football field and escaped the flood, or because he got drunk one time? Well, probably because he had enough faith to build a boat when he probably had never seen a rain shower in his life. But he did get drunk one time. Is Abraham in Hebrews chapter 11 because he left his home and his family and his father's house and went to a land just wherever God told him to go, and he had great faith and the father of the faithful, or is it because he laughed at God's promises and lied at least two times about his wife? Well, it's because he had great faith and followed God, but he did lie a couple of times, and he did fall on his face and laugh when he thought God could give him a son when he was as old as he was. Why is Moses in Hebrews chapter 11? Is it because finally, under reluctance, he was able and encouraged by God to look at the most powerful man in all the earth and say, let my people go, or because he killed a man one time? Well, it's because he was willing to face the most powerful man on earth and say, let my people go, and he did kill a man one time. But when he gets to Hebrews chapter 11, God said, here's what I want you to remember about these people and Samson and Barak and Jephthah and Rahab and all of these others, David and all of them. Some good points, some bad points. You don't have to imitate everything to imitate some things. And so I need to recognize my family. Now, the questionnaire that you have is something that I did one time when I went to a workshop on this. One of the best ways that I can relate to my family is to understand my family. And here's some questions I got out of the book that I've mentioned here. And I just went and spent a day in Perry County and just asked aunts and uncles, and let's just talk about all of these. And it's interesting. See, when I understand my family, I may be able to change some family rules without doing disrespect to the family. You've probably heard the illustration, but it's the best I've ever heard. Young couple was married. They wanted to be perfect, and so they didn't want to criticize. And the husband noticed every time his wife cooked a ham, she'd cut off about 3 or 4 inches and throw it away. And he didn't want to criticize, but after he saw her do that a half a dozen times, he hated to lose all that good ham. And he said, honey, why are you throwing the end of that ham away? And she said, well, Mama taught me to cook, and that's the way she always did it. He said, okay. Why didn't you do that? She said, I don't know. That's just the way Mama did it. He said, well, let's ask. And so they asked Mama, do you? Yeah, I do that. Why? Well, she said, my Mama taught me to cook, and that's the way my Mama always did it. Why? I don't know. Let's ask Grandmama. And so they asked Grandma, do you throw the, yeah. Why do you do that? She said, I had a very small pan. Once you understand that, you don't have to throw the ham away anymore. When you understand why they did it, it gives us some insight, and we don't have to do anything exactly the way they did it and still honor our family. I need to understand the law of the triangle. Probably more problems come up in groups because of the triangle. We have a difference. Let's say Jerry Wester and I here. I've got something against him. Instead of going to Jerry and talking to him, I might go to this Jerry over here and say, that fellow from Tennessee, he just irritates the daylights out of me. And since you're an elder of the Lord's church, I'd like for you to get him straightened out. Would you do that, please? I think it's your duty as a godly. Well, yeah, since I'm an elder, I guess I should. So how do I feel? Man, I feel great. I've unloaded all of that. I'm going to have him straighten out my friend. And so he feels worse. And what's going to happen? Absolutely nothing. And many times that's what causes conflict in a family, in a group, in a church, in a softball team, in a business. My son calls it delivering mail to the wrong address. And the Bible addresses that. Proverbs 18:17, the first to plead his cause seems right until his neighbor comes and examines him. Leviticus 19:16, you shall not go about as a talebearer among your people. Proverbs 26, verse 20, where there is no wood, the fire goes out. Where there is no wood, Where there is no talebearer, contention ceases. When I go and work with a church in conflict, I ask a number of questions, and about question number 5 is this one. Who is keeping this matter stirred up in this church? It's been going on several months. Who's keeping this stirred up? Proverbs 26:20 says, where there's no wood, the fire goes out. Where there's no talebearer, contention ceases. Who is carrying wood to the fire? Somebody's talking to the wrong people. How do I know? The Bible tells me so. And you know why that happens in a church, in a family, in a softball team, in a business? Because everybody likes it that way. We like it the way it is better than what it would take to change it. Because it takes two people to gossip. It takes one to talk, one to listen. Years ago, Bell South mailed out a brochure with their weekly bill on, this was before caller ID, how to stop obscene phone calls. You know what that article said? You know how you stop obscene phone calls? Hang up. Takes two people to make an obscene phone call, one to be talking, another to be listening. And you can't do it if you hang up. You know what it takes to sustain gossip? Somebody to talk and somebody to listen. If you have rules, principles in a group, and somebody says, you know, I just can't stand our elders. I tell you, I don't know why. They just say, when did you meet with them last? Well, I hadn't. You got the mail to the wrong mailbox. You need to talk to them. I can't accept that message. I hadn't got my name on it. You have anything against me? No, I ain't got anything. It's just those out. Well, you need to talk to them. Wrong person here. I have a written, part of my written contract is that all criticism of Jerry Barber goes straight to Jerry Barber. Jerry Barber does not accept anonymous criticism. See, years earlier, I'd have people, you know, a lot of people are upset. A lot of people are upset. Who are? Well, I can't tell you, but there's a lot of people. I don't know who that is. And I don't accept anonymous criticism. So I'll need to talk to those folks straight. So if I understand something of how families work, that can be helpful. I read a book that has been helpful. I try not to learn very much. I learned 2 or 3 things in this book. It's called Secrets of Your Family Tree, Help for Adult Children of Dysfunctional Families. I learned 2 or 3 things. Number one, I came to the conclusion that every family is dysfunctional. That's 1 John 1:8. If we say that we have no dysfunction, we deceive ourselves and the truth's not in us. John used the word sin. That means missing the mark. So every family doesn't do it all right. Number two, he wrote a chapter about the dysfunctional family of Abraham and the dysfunctional family of David. And so that gave me a lot of hope. If they both had dysfunctional families, and they did, and he's the father, one's the father of the faithful, and the other's a man after God's own heart, then there's hope for the Barber family. Another, he gave us three rules of having a good dysfunctional family. Really dysfunctional: don't talk, don't trust, don't feel. Those are the three rules of a dysfunctional family. There's some things we just don't talk about in this house. Yeah. And what we don't talk about, we'll divide about and divorce about. We need to be able to talk about anything we need to talk about that affects us. Number two, don't trust. You just can't trust people. Sure you can. You need to do it through creative doubt, and don't be gullible, but we can build trust. Well, you just can't feel that way here. You can't feel anger. I read an article this past week from a good old Christian lady who said it was a sin to be angry. Must be reading a different Bible. My Bible says in Ephesians 4:26, be angry and do not sin. In your anger, do not sin. And her answer to that was, well, it says to put away all those things. Yeah, put away bitterness, wrath, anger, clamor, and evil speaking. And the way you put away bitterness, which is old anger that's never been processed, is to be angry at the right time, at the right place, with the right person, the right way. And if I do not process that, then it'll get old and stinky, and it'll clabber in my refrigerator, and the cereal won't taste good. That's the disadvantage of living in two houses, is having old milk. And I know when it goes glug, 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 it's going to be a bad day. And so, and the family need to be able to have our feelings. Number three, that was a long week too. Number three, we need to study together. If faith is going to grow in our family, we need to study together. We experienced that through family Bible reading and listening. We did a thing I started in 1981, our trip through the Bible. We call it the Book of the Month Club. Johnny Ramsey was in a gospel meeting, and he said, if I were a young preacher, the first thing I'd do is preach through the whole Bible. It was too late for me to do that as a young preacher, but I thought I could get started then. And so we started in January of 1981, and on the second Sunday night, I'd preach on a book of the Bible. We'd encourage everybody to read and or listen to that. And so as a family, we would read and or listen to that book during that month. And that's something we remember fondly. Lectureships, workshops, Christian training series, Horizons was always, it used to be Future Church Leaders Workshop. That was always a family outing when our kids were growing up. And now our grandkids are going to that and enjoying it tremendously. Week number four, vacation together. 1995, I guess, we started going as a family to Ware's Valley in the Smoky Mountains, halfway between Townsend and Pigeon Forge. Rent a cabin, and everybody's invited. My mama and my daddy, and dad died 2 years ago, but he went, and Gail and I and our kids and our grandkids. And so we spend some time in family devotional. We play together. We pray together. I don't think this... Let me just tell you what we always chose to do when we were traveling and on vacation. We find a local congregation. I think you can probably do it in the cabin if you want to, but we just like to do that and say, what did you learn today? I remember one night we were at a small congregation on a Wednesday night. There were 12 people, and we had four of them. And so that night, as we talked together, what if when you get grown and married, you move into a community and this church has eight people? What are you going to do? You going to quit the church? You're going to go join a denomination? How would you handle that? Or would you get in and work and try to evangelize? How would you deal with that? And so we just talked about that, because that is a possibility. And so I always found worshiping with people wherever we are was just something really neat. Week number five, spend time alone. I think one of the best ways to stay together is spend some time apart. From time to time, my wife Gail says, I think it's about time for you to go on a gospel meeting by yourself. And I think it is. It's good. I love Mark chapter 6, 31, 45, and 46. Mark chapter 6 is book, chapter, and verse authorization for me to take naps on Sunday afternoon or any other time I think I need to. Jesus came to his disciples and he said, you've been so busy, you haven't even had time to eat. You need to get away and rest a while. And you know what happened right after that? Fed 5,000 men beside the women and children, picked up 12 basketfuls after they got through. And so in verse 45, he came back again and he constrained them. He made them get into a boat and go out on the Sea of Galilee. Turn off your cell phones. Don't take your laptop. Don't answer any email. Get out in there and rest a while. He constrained them to do that. That was a hard lesson for me to learn. I remember one day when I was a youngster, Daddy came in and he said he'd gotten a raise. He was thrilled. I can still see the smile on his face. And I made this statement, Daddy, since you got a raise, you're going to have to work harder. And here's what he said, boy, I want to tell you something. You don't get a raise, you don't work harder because you got a raise. You got a raise because you were already working harder. So, boy, I learned that, and I learned that, and I learned that. And so I learned it probably too much. And so there were years in my life that I wouldn't answer a telephone in bed. Had it right there on the nightstand, phone ring in the middle of the night. Pull back the cover, stand straight up, answer the phone. Jerry, I'm sorry you're in bed. Well, I'm not in bed. I'm standing straight up. What do you think I am, a lazy preacher? You think I rest at 2:30 in the morning? No, sir. What do you need? Isn't that weird? I remember the first time, a Saturday morning in Dalton, Georgia, out in Crow Valley where we live. The first time. This was a spiritual victory for me. First time I remember. I answered the phone at 8 o'clock in the morning in bed. Told the truth about it, rolled over and went back to sleep, and didn't feel guilty. Wow, that is wonderful. That's wonderful. It's okay to rest every once in a while. It's all right to take a nap. Now, here's what's interesting. Jesus pushed his disciples out into the sea, and then he turned around and went the other direction. He went to a mountain to pray. Send them over there. I need to get away from you. I love lectureships. Go to Fried Hardeman every year. Go to others. The best study I've ever done in my life for 3 weeks when I've called a week in isolation by myself. Don't take my wife. Don't take anybody else. I go on electronic fast. I love computers and MP3s and CDs and listen to hundreds of those a year. I don't do any of that. Don't do any internet. I call home once a day to be sure everybody's still alive. I get up at 6 in the morning, walk 30 minutes. I usually run. I try to interrupt my schedule, walk 30 minutes, take a shower, shave. I'm studying by 8 o'clock. I do that until 10 o'clock at night, go back to bed and get up and do the next day. It's time to interrupt the schedule and evaluate. And I think I'm a better person, a better leader of my family, a better preacher of the gospel after I do that. Week number 6, have good parties. Preach a sermon in these congregations where I do interim ministry on how we need to have more funerals and parties. We need to have parties to celebrate the good stuff in our life. Luke chapter 15, when that prodigal son came home, the father said, bring out the best robe and put it on and put a ring on his hand, shoes on his feet, kill the fatted calf. Let's make merry, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. They began to be merry. We need to have parties. Celebrate birthdays, anniversaries, significant accomplishments. I believe that one of the reasons a lot of people get burned out and discouraged and quit is because they just get so tired. They say life is one big job which is never finished. Not any way in the world ever get through. Well, there's another way to do that. And that is to follow some biblical principles. Let's celebrate when we have finished significant events. Acts chapter 14, I like what happened. Paul and Barnabas had been on that first missionary journey. They had left Antioch, came down to Cyprus, hit a couple of places over into Asia Minor, came back, helped organize, encourage. And then it says, after they had gone to the last town, from there they sailed to Antioch, Acts 14, 26, where they had been commended to the grace of God for the work which they had completed. Hear that? They had completed that work. Now, when they had come together and gathered the church together, they reported that all that God had done with them and that he had opened the door of faith to the Gentiles, so they stayed there a long time with the disciples. So it says, the work of God which they had completed. So Paul's retiring. He said, oh, no. Paul's going to do missionary journey number three, trip to Rome and a lot of other things, write some books. But for this one time, they came and said, we have completed this work. I remember when we were living in Crow Valley, we had made that mortgage. And I like numbers and graphs. And so when I made the mortgage, I made a chart on a piece of paper that had a block for every monthly payment we'd make until it was paid off. And I'd color it. And so I didn't see it as losing money. I saw it as getting to color another little red square. And so I looked forward to every house payment. And I looked up one day and we were half through. And I said, you know, we don't need to wait to have a party until we pay the whole thing off. We can have a half paying the house off party. And so we went to Chattanooga and let the kids select a restaurant. And we just said, we're here to celebrate. We're half through of paying our house off. Let's have a party. And so I think we need to do that. I've talked with the elders here about having deacon appreciation parties. Need to have elder appreciation parties. That's taught in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. We need to have parties. Need to have parties in our families. Week number seven, we need to have good funerals. Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Most funerals that I preach, I read Ecclesiastes chapter 7. It's just an amazing passage. A good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. Better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men. The living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. I tell people, I don't know why you're at this funeral today. It may be because you're kin to the person, you know some of the people, maybe you knew the person, but I hope you'll get a spiritual experience. Solomon said it's better to go to a funeral than to go to a party. Now, it's not more fun, it's not recreation, it's not entertaining, it's better. And if I think, which I believe is one of the most spiritual things that a person can do, I'm thinking at this funeral, you know, we've come to honor this person and think about this person here. One of these days, I'm going to go to a funeral and I'll be the one in the casket. I couple that with Hebrews 11:4. Abel still is dead and he's still talking. And you know, we're going to be talking one of these days after we die. And if I don't like the speech that I would make, I still have time to change my speech. One of these days, we're going to be dead and we're all going to end up on the wall at Cracker Barrel. One of the things that I dearly enjoy, I got a lot of pleasures that don't cost a lot. I like to call the manager to Cracker Barrel and say, come here, I want to ask you a question. See up there on the fireplace, tell me about that man up there on the fireplace. And you know what they've done 100% of the time? They say, I don't know him. You don't know him and you got him hanging up over your fireplace? How do you get there? Here's my theory. People die and the family argues over who. I want the picture. No, I want the picture. Mama loved me. No, she loved me more. Second generation, you want it? Well, no. Well, yeah, okay, I'll take it. Third generation, who? I don't know. You want it? No, I don't want it. I don't want it either. What are we going to do? Sell it to Cracker Barrel. So we're all going to end up, but we're still going to be talking for generations after we die, and so we need to have good funerals, and we need to think while we're having our funerals. We need to do that at the death of family, friends, and pets. We need to do that when children leave and get married. One of the things I do in premarital counseling, I start in the first session, how are you grieving what you're going to lose by being single? And Gail and I have a session right at the last called In-Law Stew. And in In-Law Stew, we'll get to mom and daddy of the bride, mom and daddy of the groom, the bride and the groom, and she makes up the base of the stew with meat and tomato paste, and they each one brings a can of vegetable. We pour them in and eat them, and then we talk about them. We ask, how are you grieving the loss of your children? And here's what most say. I'm not losing a son, I'm gaining a daughter. And I look them straight in the eye and I say, no, that is not correct. You are gaining a daughter and losing a son. Genesis 2:27, for this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and they shall be one flesh. The couple I was counseling several years ago were getting married, and at Thanksgiving and Christmas, instead of going together to their parents, they went by themselves and they said, this is the last year we will be with you at Thanksgiving as a single person. We want to thank you for raising us in a Christian home for all you've done. It'll be different. See, it doesn't mean it's going to be bad, but it's going to be different. And if you don't grieve and have a funeral over that relationship, you may not have the resurrection that it'll take to be a good in-law. It's folks who are still trying to make like nothing has ever changed. It causes a lot of conflict in families. And so if we want our faith to grow and our families to be happy, we need to grieve the loss that we have. It may come in moving, changing jobs, retirement. Two books. I've got 24 seconds and we'll be through. One is called Good Grief by Granger Westberg. It describes processes of grief. I've given away many, many of these. And it tells me I'm not going crazy when I go through all of the depression and physical symptoms and all kinds of things and grief. An elder introduced to me is called Tear Soup. Tear Soup is, I call it a children's book for adults. Big pictures, not many words, good information on how to grieve and to grieve well. Thank you for your good attention and the opportunity to talk to you today. Let's pray. Father, thank you for this day and the opportunity we've had to study from your word. Help us to build faith in our families. In Christ's name we pray. Amen.